Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning, and welcome to For Your Benefit. I'm your guest host today, Bob Braunstein. I'm a federal retirement and benefits expert, and I'm also a presenter for National Institute of Transition Planning in their various seminars throughout the country. We're doing a little bit of role reversal today. My guest, or actually the host of the show, is with us today as well, Bob Lyons. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Bob. I'm nervous. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here. Before we get any further, though, this show is, you know, basically runs on the questions we receive from our loyal listeners. If any of you have questions during the show, please feel free to give us a call at 202-465-3080. You can also email questions to us at foryourbenefit@federalnewsradio.com while we're on the air, or 24/7 to foryourbenefit@nitp.com. So what we're going to do today is sort of get around the taxability of your federal benefits. As I teach classes throughout the country for NITP, I get lots of questions that I have to say, you know, that's a tax question and it's beyond my pay grade. You might have to wait until tomorrow until a tax expert, which is frequently Bob Lyons, shows up and deals with the taxability issues. To kick things off, I'm going to start out with a question that I get from lots of folks concerning their contribution to FERS, or CSRS, which will produce the annuities that they've been working very hard for throughout their careers. The question might go like this. I understand that my contributions to FERS are already taxed, and that they will come back to me in my first series of annuity checks. How does this happen, and how do I know what I've already contributed? Bob?
Here we go. During one's career, FERS, CSRS, offset, Metro, Title IV doesn't make any difference. As a federal civilian, it's important civilian. The military doesn't have this. They have an involuntary amount of money withheld each pay period to, quote, fund retirement. Doesn't have anything to do with the thrift. Doesn't have anything to do with IRAs. It's just like if you want an annuity, you have to pay for it. It's probably the deal of the century. But nonetheless, there's a very small percentage that's taken out for FERS. People, what's it, 0.8%?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And for CSRSers, it's 7% of their salary. So the point being is that money's been withheld since your first civilian federal paycheck and last to your last civilian federal paycheck. And the money's already been taxed. It sits somewhere. It sits at OPM. So that when you retire, and this is somewhat new, not brand new, OPM makes the calculation as to what's taxable of your annuity and what's not. And you'd say, well, why should there be some non-taxable? Because it's considered to be a return of this, quote, investment, this involuntary withholdings. It wasn't always the case. Many, many years ago, you got it all up front. It was called the three-year rule.
I was going to ask you a question about that. Why did that change?
It was, I think, somewhat simple. I tend to be an optimistic person. I don't look at things from a negative standpoint, but this one was, to me, both positive and negative, tax-wise. Under the old three-year rule, now we're talking 86, we're talking years ago, people would get this money, and the first money that you were paid in the form of an annuity was considered to be the first money taken out of the pot. So everything was non-taxable until your annuity in sum equaled what you'd put into the system over your lifetime. It was called the three-year rule. And when I first saw that they kicked it out, and they basically now they spread it out over Congress's perception of your lifetime, which is a little robust. So the tax deduction doesn't mean as much now as it did then. And so when I first saw it, I said, well, they're just trying to collect the money more up front now rather than let the people go for 2 or 3 years. However, on the other hand, I'm not so sure the old three-year rule was everybody's best friend, because when many people retire, the major source of their income is their annuity. So that if the annuity's non-taxable, they lost itemized deductions, they lost personal exemptions, they lost things that would otherwise give them a tax benefit. All in all, though, I think the front-loading was probably not a bad deal, and spreading it out over a longer period of time probably means more to people as far as a tax deduction goes, but they have to wait for the rest of their life to get the full tax benefit out of it.
Well, not to beat a dead horse to death, but on the same issue, I get questions all the time about from people who have been in multiple federal agencies, who've had multiple payroll offices, and they're always trying to get a bead on exactly how much they've put into their retirement, into FERS. Once they retire, how can they know exactly what they've put into that pot?
Actually, I'd suggest that they do it before they retire.
Uh-huh.
And they can do it, and they'll have to write OPM. Notice I said write. So they're not going to be able to go on site. They're not going to be able to call up. And I can give the address. It's OPM Retirement Operations Center, P.O. Box 45, Boyers, Pennsylvania, 16017. OPM Retirement Operations Center, P.O. Box 45, Boyers, PA, 16017. All righty. Now, if you write them, give them a hand and say, gee, my career started November 1986. This is roughly the agencies that I was in. And they have a very nice printout. It's not going to come next week, but it's not going to come next year either. And it would have all the now, this is very interesting. It would have all the contributions that OPM has. What does OPM have? It has everything from day one until they last changed pay centers. So if you were had your pay center changed to DFAS, to New Orleans, at that date, the box on your last leave and earnings statement became a zero, and all the numbers are at OPM. The number on your last leave and earnings statement is all the money since they last changed pay centers. Mm. The exception to that would be intelligence agencies seem not to outsource their payroll.
Right. So if I'm retiring, in essence, OPM should have most, probably all of the information prior to the time that I came to the agency from which I'm leaving. And, you know, then it would be up to my agency to forward the rest of my payroll history, et cetera, over to OPM when I retire, at which point they would have a complete picture of what my contributions to retirement would be.
And I use this example in the class. Somebody will say, what if? And I said, let's cut out the what ifs. What if your first job is currently your last job? Your desk is the same desk over the last 30 years. You did get a new telephone and probably got a new chair. But your last leave and earnings statement still only is since they last changed pay centers. And they sent out a memo at the time and say, save your last pay stub. Now, why would somebody else want to write OPM other than to know what the number is? And I'm not remotely suggesting that they do that. But let's say somebody left federal service and then came back. They made a redeposit. They paid interest on it. Those numbers are in there. The interest now. It becomes a tax deduction at the date of retirement. Let's say somebody bought military time. That number's in there. And the interest is in there as well. Now, if I wrote that kind of check, I think I want to know that it's there. I'm not saying OPM messes it up, not in the slightest.
Got it. Let's switch a little bit. I get this question all the time. People ask me about disability retirement, and they compare it with workers' compensation. Workers' compensation is tax-free. Disability retirement is not. And they ask me, what's the difference? I mean, I'm disabled. Clearly, in one instance, I'm disabled on the job or as a result of my employment, but even with a disability retirement, I'm disabled. Why is disability retirement taxable and workers' compensation not taxable?
Now, potentially, it could be non-taxable, but the person would have to be in extremely rough shape. So, Congress over the years, these tax laws, some are good, some are not for any particular individual with any particular case. So they said, unless you really can't do anything, unless you're really in bad shape, you're going to pay taxes on it. People would say, well, what if I'm 20% disabled? And the military still have this, but the federal service does not. So unless you're really, really in rough shape, you're paying taxes on it.
Now, there was a time when disability retirement was non-taxable. That changed a number of years ago, right?
Right. And about the only way that you could now is, they call it the lump sum rule, that if somebody is actually near death, The first hours that they get are considered to be the first hours they put in, and they can use that old three-year rule. But they, again, it's a pretty grim situation. No one would want to be in that situation.
For sure. All right, let's talk a little bit about some of the benefits that we get. When I'm working as a federal employee and I have federal employees' health benefits, I enjoy the benefits of what's known as premium conversion. My health insurance premiums that I paid during the year actually come off my adjusted gross income. Now, that's fine while I work, but most of us, when we retire, lose the premium conversion benefit. The government continues to pay its share of my premium, and I pay for it monthly, but no longer do I get that tax break. Why does that change?
You got me. It's just another way to get somebody, I suppose. So
you mean I've stumped the master?
No, I mean, I look at these laws and I read, they have things called committee reports that really show you how this idea started, the compromises and whatnot. And it was just, well, we have to tighten up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they did it. But different things go into the law depending on the lobby strength of the group. Now, one of them, law enforcement. Law enforcement individuals with regards to their annuity, and remember the OPM makes the calculation as to what's taxable versus what is not and sends you a form each year in the month of January. It's kind of like a W-2, but it's called a Form 1099-R. But what they say is law enforcement, public safety officers. Now, this is really because somebody's going to call me and say, no, you're wrong, public safety employees. It's kind of a really slick move. We're talking about PSO, public safety officers, which would be somebody in law enforcement.
I heard that chaplains are included in that sometimes, too. Is that true?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, so what is it, though? Up to $3,000 of your health insurance, if you have health insurance of under $3,000 coming out of your annuity, then it would be limited to that number. If it was over $3,000, it would be limited to $3,000. And it's an add-on to the number that we just talked about, the life spread of the amount the money put in. Who knows why that came in? But for a while, people didn't know, and I'm not so sure everybody still knows. And it's as simple as putting something on the front of the 1040 and just put PSO to the left hand of line 16B. That's it. And make sure you do it right, though.
My accountant always does that. I never do those things. Here's an interesting question that we've gotten in the last few weeks from several people. If I'm still working at a fairly high salary, does it make sense to delay drawing Social Security, even though I've reached my full retirement age for Social Security, say 66 or 67, where the work income reduction no longer applies? I'm concerned, you know, because I'm making a lot of money, and if I start drawing Social Security, won't it increase my tax base? So shouldn't I delay drawing my Social Security?
Okay, Social Security, I think it's fair to say, and this is for the federal audience, this is not necessarily for the non-federal audience, there's three different levels on which Social Security is going to be taxed. I won't do the numbers because they're a little mind-numbing. But I think the listening audience, you're talking about paying tax on 85% of it.
That's right.
Doesn't much make any difference whether you're FERS or CSRS unless you've got a really short federal career and no other income. You're paying tax on 85% of it. So let me be clear, though. Let's say your Social Security is $10,000. Just use that as a benchmark. Multiply it by whatever you want. You pay tax on $8,500 of it. It's not an 85% tax, so it just gets added into your other income, and it's taxed like everything else.
So it's taxed at your bracket.
Right.
Got it.
But I'd rather look at it in the reverse, and I'm not always accused of being looking at things in reverse. It's 15% non-taxable. It's very tax efficient, and in many cases on your state return, it's not taxable at all. That's not the case with your federal annuity. So from a tax perspective, I think I jump on it. But I think taxes should never come before economics. The tax tail shouldn't wag the dog. So the economics would say, I'm still working, I'm going to get taxed, and we'll visit whether we're going to be in a higher tax bracket or not when we retire. But let's just leave that go for a second. So we are getting it And in theory, if we save it, then when we hit 70, then we start to draw it out and get what we would have gotten at 70, and probably going to last 10, 12 years. So what you're saying for economics, you're willing to wait until 70 to get the higher amount. If you have real bad genes, don't wait.
In other words, do you feel lucky?
Yeah, do you feel lucky? What did you? What did we talk about last week, Bob? The Clint Eastwood...
Oh, you mean a man's got to know his limitations?
Yeah.
I don't know whether that necessarily... true, your health limitations.
Yeah.
So if I understand you correctly, let's say 10,000 is my Social Security, and let's assume that my marginal tax rate is 25%. You know, that $8,500, I mean... let's just say it barely, you know, gets into maybe the higher bracket or whatever. I'm really only paying 25% on that $8,500, so it really makes sense to start drawing it, because otherwise, as you artistically said, if I wait four more years, I'll get an additional 8% per year on that benefit, but then you have to look at a break-even period, you know, which is roughly 10 to 12 years. I'd have to live that much longer in order to make up what I wasn't collecting to that point in time, and then finally get a bigger entitlement for the rest of my life.
Right.
Got it.
And when I do this in class, people look at me and say, "You expect me to save that?" And I go, "I'm just, you know, I'm a bean counter. This is the way I think." So your example of the 25%, I think, is a fairly solid number. If you're in the 15% bracket, it might start to make some sense. Because the tax is so low. And generally, there's no state tax.
Okay. Something that's currently happening right now, it's on the minds of many folks, that the whole business of furloughs. People are concerned, you know, if I'm furloughed, I know that my federal retirement benefit technically wouldn't be affected if the furlough is for less than 6 months in a calendar year. I mean, that's, you know, the six-month rule and non-pay status. But if, let's say if I'm furloughed for only 22 days, which is you know, the number that's being tossed around, what about my tax liability? You know, at the end of the year, is that going to be unchanged, or is that going to be?
Well,
you know,
they're not going to get the money.
Right.
So again, whatever tax bracket, but in this case, we're probably talking about both federal and state. So, not to make an assumption for every state in the country, the combined amount here could be 30%, especially while we're working. And that's, I mean, the good news is you're not paying tax on the money you don't get, and you're saving 30% in tax. The bad news is you lost 70%.
Got it. Yeah, and on the benefits side, what I always tell folks, too, is, you know, I'm not saying don't worry about furloughs, but if you're worried about furloughs, then we'll talk about that in a second. But what I wanted to remind the listeners today is that if you have any questions at all, please feel free to give us a call at 202-465-3080. That's 202-465-3080. We love to hear from you. You know, basically keep us in the weeds. That's what makes the show as exciting and inviting to us. And please feel free to call. And remember, you can also email us at foryourbenefit@federalnewsradio.com. Okay.
And you can ask benefit questions and Social Security questions.
All right. Do you have any benefit questions for me along the lines of what we're talking about?
Oh, you know, over the years, I mean, it's been many years, fortunately, being around folks like you, Tammy, Linda, Vanessa, John, et cetera, I've been lazy. And I really don't know benefits. I think I understand the high three. I think I understand in grade. I understand buybacks and whatnot. But I'm always mystified. And you know this, after every show we do, and same thing with the other benefits speakers, I say, how do you know that stuff? And you all look at me and say, how do you know your stuff? And I really think yours is harder. Because you got to remember some act back in 1956 and... Actually, I went after listening to somebody. I'd work with the post office, and I worked for the SBA, summer jobs and part-time jobs. And I was saying, I wonder if I got 5 years. I was about 4.5 years short.
Well, I think you have a great command of it. I think, you know, for somebody who knows as much as you do about taxes, which is a full-time job and you have your own practice, your ability to bring back into your own mind federal benefits and shape it around the tax issues is, I think you're unparalleled. I really think you do a great job. And I'm just saying that because, you know, I ask you a lot of questions and you know it. Like, you know, but let's jump back in here again. I'm always getting questions. This is a big one. It has to do with folks who have a lot of medical expenses during the year. And I've always heard that, you know, once your medical expenses exceed, say, 7.5% of your gross income, you can start taking that off your income tax. But I guess what I wanted to know was, can things like my health insurance premiums, my dental and vision insurance premiums, long-term care, can that be part of this 7.5%?
Taxes are never easy, nor is this. And the 7.5 is a good number up until December 31st last year.
Oh.
Now it's 10% to help fund the Affordable Health Care Act. Anyway, so we're going to have a lot of this. So let's get back and just dissect the different parts of your question. So if we're on the job, we have whatever health insurance is withheld is going to be added to whatever other medical expenses we have. If we're retired, whatever other medical expenses we have gets an addition to the amount that is withheld for us for health insurance, except for the PSO people that they get it all up front. Okay, so you'd say, all right, good. What about dental and vision? Same category as the health insurance. Alrighty, but what about long-term care? Now, again, here's where they start to make your hair hurt again. They say, okay, if you're between this age and this age, you can deduct your long-term care insurance, but you can't deduct more than X. But if you're between Y and Z, you can deduct X plus whatever. And it hurts. And you really need a computer program to do a tax return anymore. So to answer your question, yes. But after a certain age, then it would become fully deductible. But that's a little bit of an advanced age. So anybody listening, whatever age they are, let's hope they don't qualify for the medical expenses because they have to exceed a high percent. Now, that's just the money coming out of the federal paycheck. What about the money being spent that isn't covered under a flexible spending account? Out-of-pocket expense, co-pays, over-the-counter drugs, gauze. So if you buy it for medical purposes, it's, quote, deductible, end of quote. That doesn't mean you're going to deduct it. You can add it in to the number. And so I would say a fair percentage of people don't get this anymore. Now, as we age, sometimes people have dental implants and the like. Those are very expensive, and so they might get pushed over. And so when I'm talking to people, I say, you know, if you're looking at this right now, the end of June, July, if your expenses have been bad, I'm sorry to hear that, but you might want to accelerate whatever payments you can into the current year. At least you could get over the 10% hurdle if it's that much money. But 10% of one's total income is a substantial amount.
So it's no longer 7.5. That threshold is 10% until you get above 10. Wow. And this is as a result of funding the Affordable Care Act. Wow. It's interesting because a lot of the frequently asked questions that are out there on the web still allude to the 7.5%. And I'm still getting questions associated with that, too. So I guess I should have known that, but I didn't. That just goes to show you.
Well, you concentrate on what you concentrate on, I concentrate, and it's a good thing we're buddies, huh?
Yes, indeed. Another question that I get, some folks get subsidies in their jobs. Some of them get extra money to ride Metro. Some get paid parking. How does that figure into taxable income?
It's interesting, and it's a target of some of the tax law changes, but they have not been changed. So if you work and you're provided parking, it's a non-taxable fringe. If you pay for parking yourself, it's remote, but you might be able to get reimbursed. It's remote. Please, nobody hear that and say, well, they said I could go to you for reimbursement. It's probably not going to happen. It's just that they would otherwise be granted parking, but they can't because the parking lots are too full. As far as getting to work, in order to encourage people to use public transportation, buses, metros, or subway systems or the like, they'll get a certain amount per month tax-free.
Hmm.
And don't have to be a super grade for that. It's just it's a way to keep people off the highways. It seems to make some sense.
Sure, sure. Here's a good question that I get. If I die, I have designations of beneficiary that I have filled out for a variety of my benefits, TSP, life insurance, and several other things. But chief among them might be my life insurance benefit, or, you know, sometimes I might have a lot of TSP. But my life insurance benefit, if I'm gone, do my beneficiaries have to pay taxes on that life insurance if they receive it?
Life insurance is non-taxable.
Ah, okay.
Premiums are non-deductible. Sometimes it's a relationship to deductible premiums and whatever it might be. But in this case, life insurance is not. But one needs to be careful. This gets into a little estate planning. So if we have a sizable chunk of life insurance and it goes to, say, our spouse, not everybody's married, it goes to a friend. Now it's a part of their asset. So upon their passing, if those assets have gone over a certain value, now at the federal level, this is pretty high. It's $5 million. But at the state level, it may not be, it will not be that high. And so you got to watch out for estate taxes. So you can have something as simple. It's called a life insurance trust. It sounds horribly exotic, but it's basically a checking account that is funded with somebody's contributions to it and pays the premium. We do have a caller, though.
Very good.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bob. I'm Bob. This is Ed Zerndorfer.
Hey, Ed.
Good morning.
I have to leave.
Yeah, that's it. I'm going under the table now.
No. Just want to add to what you correctly said, Bob. Bob Lyons talking about, because I want to just point out some of the things, questions I get in class regarding the taxation of federal retirement benefits, and that is regarding the simplified rule, how a CSRS or FERS annuity is taxed. It used to be, before 2002, an employee, a retiree, or their accountant had to figure out the taxable portion of the annuity. OPM gave them all the information on their 1099-R, but it was up to the annuitant or the accountant to figure out how the simplified rule works. But effective in 2002, OPM did all the work for the annuitant. So the taxable portion of their gross annuity, whether it's CSRS or FERS, shows up on their 1099-R that they receive every January. I just wanted to point that out.
You know, you're absolutely right, Ed. I've looked at mine this past year, and it says, here's what we paid you, basically, and then right under there is a slightly lower figure which says this is your taxable amount.
Well, when I retired under CSRS back in 2006, I got that 1099-R in the following January for showing what my gross annuity was for calendar year 2006. And it showed on the 1099-R the original contributions, which includes military deposits and deposits for temporary time, redeposits, all that type of stuff. And I actually sat down with the simplified rule to verify the numbers, and they came absolutely to the penny. OPM did it correctly. So it really would not hurt individuals who do their own taxes, because I know that programs like TurboTax have the simplified rule built in to it. So you can actually very easily verify the numbers, but OPM has taken all the fun out of it, if you will, for annuitants. However, I've had some experience, though, with survivor annuitants that OPM does not show the taxable portion of the survivor annuity. And they asked me, what happens here? I says, well, I'll give you the good news. The good news is that whatever the annuitant was receiving tax-free, a return of their contributions, the survivor annuitant under the simplified rule also gets back the same amount each month tax-free, a return of the contribution. And it's only if the survivor annuitant lives to the full joint life expectancy, at that point all of it's going to be taxable. So I always point that out to survivor annuitants, that they really have to know what their annuitant was receiving tax-free each month under the simplified rule.
All righty, Ed.
So just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, sir.
Among the questions we get in class.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Take care.
My pleasure.
Thanks for calling.
My pleasure.
Okay. Let's see. I had another good question in here. I guess I was talking about furloughs. I don't think we finished that one. Well, we did finish that one. I might have even run out of questions. I was going to ask you all kinds of stuff, but you pretty much covered them all. And
okay, let me
ask you one more.
All right.
I make contributions to the Thrift Savings Plan. Now, I know I can do Roth contributions now, which are an after-tax contribution, but, you know, I basically have been making most of my contributions on a, I guess you call, tax-deferred basis. And I'm at the point where, you know, I'm starting to draw my money down. Well, even before I get there, I know I'm exempt from federal and state taxation on this money, but I'm a FERS employee, and I also pay FICA tax. Is the contribution I make to TSP, is that exempt from FICA taxation, which is Social Security taxes?
Oh, no.
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 No, it's not. Because that's a... Well, so in other words, they look... When I'm taxed for Social Security purposes, let's assume that I'm making, you know, below what the taxable wage base maximum is, $113,700. Let's say my salary is $90,000 a year, and I'm putting in, you know, the whole enchilada for TSP, maybe $17,500, I'm still paying payroll tax on that?
Both FICA and Medicare.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And you pay Medicare if you were making $19 million a year.
Why don't they exempt that? I don't get it. I mean, after all, I'm not getting the compensation.
I think it gets back to my sometimes negative way of looking at things. Prior to a few years ago, you could make whatever, and Medicare would stop when FICA stopped. And then they go, well, we need some more money for Medicare, so it's limitless now.
Mm-hmm.
Could have two jobs, could have a side business. You're going to pay Medicare. And if you had, a small business and you put some money away into an IRA or a self-employed retirement plan, it's just like your paycheck. You're paying Social Security and Medicare on it. So, yeah, it's there to stay. There are very few things that are exempted from that.
Now, I heard there was a proposal, too, to perhaps Medicare tax investment income when you start drawing that down. I don't think that's a reality yet, but that's out there. It's one of the things they're thinking about.
Well, it's actually a 3.8% surcharge, and it's effective this year. Now, somebody has to make an awful lot of money to be hit with this. But investment income... could be interest, could be dividends, it could be capital gains, would be subject to the regular income tax rate, and these people are going to be in pretty high brackets. But then they would also have to pay an additional 3.8% Medicare tax on top of that. Now, before anybody mishears this, let's make sure we understand what it is. When you file your tax return, there are different things on the return that light up. One of the first things that lights up is called adjusted gross income. What is adjusted gross income? It's really very simply put for most of us. It would be our taxable salary after the thrift. It would be any investment income we have. It might be Social Security. It might be this. It might be that. Just normal things. That's the total before you get to your itemized deductions. And after deductible IRAs, it's probably not going to happen. If that number and you're married is over $250,000, then this 3.8% kicks in. Adjusted gross, not taxable. If you're single, that number is $200,000. And if you file married filing separately, I feel for you because, not that I do, the tax rate is extremely high, but that number would be over $150,000. So, yeah, you heard right. So some of you all might remember when you filed your tax returns during the Vietnam War, they had a war tax, surtax, and it actually came and went after the war was over. But this, and I don't know when this is going away. I don't think it's going away.
That's interesting. Here's one for you. I get a lot of people who talk to me about court orders. You know, they have a former spouse, and the court order is giving the spouse a certain portion of their annuity, an entitlement, an equity entitlement, if you will. I think that's what the formal term is called. And the question they ask me is, all right, so how's that going to work? Am I going to be taxed on my entire annuity? How is my annuity even going to be paid? I mean, what does OPM do? What is my tax liability if, say, a third of my annuity income is going to a former spouse because of this court order.
Okay. Now, this is my understanding of it. The individual who earned the annuity is the one that put the money into the system, not the ex-spouse. And an ex-spouse could be male or female, so nobody should misunderstand what I'm trying to say here. It's an example. Mm-hmm. All right? And the argument would be that in the divorce discussions, one never brought up this money that had previously been taxed.
Got it.
So if it's not, you know, a marital asset that was separated, then the one would get the 100%. So a good attorney is going to make sure that that's done accurately.
So if I'm getting, say, two-thirds of my income, I guess OPM is probably going to be cutting two checks. One's going to go to my ex-spouse and two-thirds, and one's going to come to me for two-thirds. I only have to pay taxes on what I actually get, correct? Or do I have to?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm with you. Yes. It's only what you get.
Right.
But what you get minus whatever the tax benefit is, assuming that you got the whole amount or assuming somehow it got split during the marital years.
But you were going, but again, I know where you were going with that. You were talking about the contributions to the retirement fund, which are recovered. I would recover all of those. That would come off mine. It wouldn't come off, in my case, hers.
Unless it was negotiated at the table.
Right. And that would take an astute attorney who knew federal benefits, and I don't know whether that was the case. Of course, this isn't my situation. It's all hypothetical.
No, actually, years ago, I used to do this, and I would testify in a divorce. I mean, this was many years ago now. Mm-hmm. It's 25 years ago. But nobody knew what the federal benefit was worth. And it was pretty easy because the judge didn't know and the attorneys didn't know. Well, now people know, and they know how to calculate it in marital years, and there's some firms that do an outstanding job. But I'm not so sure maybe the average taxpayer would know that. That's why they seek professional help. Mm-hmm. I remember one. This person, will not say male or female, said, my ex-spouse wants my $40,000 that I put into the retirement system. And I said, do they want any of your annuity? Well, no. I said, write a check and get over there fast before they talk to somebody that knows better.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. And no, I'm not going to do that. And I said, fine, lose half your annuity for the rest of your life.
Oh. It's a one-time payment.
Yeah.
Recovered pretty quickly.
Yeah. And fortunately, the attorney on the other side, or whoever was advising him, it's not always an attorney, didn't know that.
You know, on the benefit side, related to this spouse equity, one of the things that a spouse can actually do, say the spouse is not federal, and the federal retiree is divorced from this individual, and they're part of their annuity is going to them, as we've been discussing. The non-federal spouse, because of the equity entitlement, is actually eligible to stay in the federal employee's health benefits plan. You know, they can actually elect coverage on their own. They can't be under the family plan of the divorced spouse because that person's no longer in their family. It's interesting. Many of them opt simply not to do this because the cost to them is exorbitant. Not only must they pay the employee share of premium, roughly 25%, they got to pay the government share as well. But they are entitled to be in FEHB, which is kind of interesting. But they can't be on their ex-spouse's plan.
All right. I got a couple thoughts. One we talk about in class. Social Security is taxable at three different levels. And Medicare is, if you will, means-based. So let's say somebody, not so much CSRS, but FERS, they have the ability to withdraw money from the TSP, I won't say as they please, but one method, they can kind of change it every year, and they might increase it. But if they increase it too high, that could kick in a higher Medicare for the next year, and then after that, it recalculates. So when somebody maybe takes a chunk out of an IRA or jacks up the TSP payment, they need to watch out that there isn't some side issue. It isn't just that it's going to be taxed as they get it. It could impact something that it's going to cost them over the next year.
So you're talking about the Medicare B premium, which is means tested. And I think the lowest amount right now is about $104 a month per person.
I've seen it pop up that somebody took too much out of an IRA one year and said, what happened? And they also, they were in the second tier of taxation of Social Security, so it kicked them up to the highest one, and it kicked up that premium.
Wow. Yeah, it doesn't take much. As an individual, income above $85,000 puts you into the second tier of that Medicare B premium, and it goes up from there. And as a couple, it's $170,000. I mean, not that everybody makes that much money in retirement, but if you did, you have to recognize that in any given point in time, that means test will kick in and your Medicare B premium may go up.
Yeah. Now, I was just introduced to this a couple weeks ago. Now, everybody follow me. And I would imagine everybody listening has got a thrift savings plan. Right? And not everybody's married. Right? This individual was married. The person with the thrift savings plan unfortunately passed early in the year. Money went to the spouse. The spouse set up an account with the TSP. And unfortunately, the spouse passed 3 months later within the same calendar year. The beneficiaries of that TSP are the children. They have to pay tax on it.
Wow. That's right. They can't inherit the TSP account.
I'm trying to find whatever I can. And I don't know that I'm going to get there, but I'm going to try to see if there's some exception to that. And this account was not small.
Now, before the provision that allowed a spouse to basically take over the TSP account, my understanding was that when the person died and you got the TSP, that it went into something called an inheritor's IRA.
Right.
Is that not the case for the children too?
Yeah, but it's they can't get it to put it into an inherited IRA. There's a roadblock called the tax machine. It says if you want to put it into an IRA, you should have maybe done some thinking prior to. So the passing then of the first to die, that should have gone to an IRA. But who knew?
Right. So they have to pay those taxes up front.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a huge chunk.
Although there's a bill. There's no bill. There's talk. The president put out a trial balloon not long ago, and one of the opportunities was, instead of somebody getting hit as hard as this, they would be able to spread it out over 5 years and pay the, you know, take one-fifth of the amount each year and keep it away from that really high bracket. Now, there's another trial balloon that was put out, I think, in the same piece of, it's not legislation, it's proposed ideas. And this one's very hard to explain, but it says that if you have a certain amount of money in your retirement funds, or you're entitled to a certain amount of money in your retirement portfolio, if you will, and it exceeds a certain amount of money for that year, you can no longer put money into any type of retirement vehicle. Okay, so what are we talking about? We're talking about the present value, and I really have a hard time explaining that. It's an amount that you would get over your lifetime discounted back because you don't get it all up front. It would be the present value of one's annuity.
Ooh.
It would be the current value of an IRA. It would be the current value of a thrift and any other type of retirement plan that somebody might have. And it would be phased in at different levels. So it doesn't mean that as you get closer to retirement, then it's going to, this could be somebody at 25, but the number is a lot different. Now, the number is very high. When you hear $2.3 million, you go, oh, well, who's got that? But you start talking about the present value of a CSRS annuity or a FERS annuity and Social Security, I'm not so sure that, together with the thrift, is going to be that much different.
Now, when you consider the amount of money you need to generate those kinds of income streams, it easily would go over that.
I do it in class, and I'm sure you do the same thing. Somebody will say, my friend has $1 million. And, you know, they're set for life. And I go, well, so do you. And they go, no, I don't. And I go, yes, you do. It's called an annuity. You know, how much money would you have to have invested someplace to pay you a $40,000 a year annuity? And again, I don't think it's more than $1 million. Not that $1 million isn't huge, but we don't think like that. I got a $40,000 annuity. Well, if you weren't covered under the feds, and I'm not playing the violin for the non-feds, in order for them to have the same annuity, they're going to have a chunk of cash someplace that's going to pay them $40,000 with a COLA over their lifetime, and I bet that's seven figures.
That's an interesting way to look at it. That's really true. You do you need a lot of money to generate your own annuity. So if you're have one of these defined annuity benefits that you do with CSRS and FERS, that's like having a million or more in the bank.
Right. And please nobody mishear what I just said. This is a trial balloon proposal that was put out, but the policing of it, can you imagine? You're going to have an actuary come and look at all your different retirement assets. So that just the sheer cost of doing this is pretty rough. And I don't know that it impacts as many people, which would be precluded from adding money to their retirement plan, as all the people having to make the calculation. So, you know, it'd become a horrible tax nuisance. Not that the rest of it isn't, but this one is particularly hard.
Let me get way into the weeds on one issue, which is sort of related to insurance, but it's a little bit different. And this is, you know, an unfortunate situation if it happens, but it affects a FERS employee who, instead of getting to retirement, is gone before they get there. If they've been working at least 18 months, and many of them are working more than that, their spouse, if they're married, is entitled to something called the FERS Lump Sum Death Benefit. And this benefit is a little over $31,000, and it includes an amount of money that's equivalent to the deceased employee's final salary, half of that paid in a lump sum. Now, this money is not life insurance. This is an addition to life insurance, and it could, in some cases, be an addition to a federal annuity payable to a spouse if the person had 10 years on the job. But as far as the lump sum is concerned, I guess it's not life insurance, to my knowledge. It's taxable.
Yep.
But what could you do with that to maybe avoid taxes for a while?
If it winds up in a W-2, then it's... You could put money into an IRA. I'm reasonably certain that they can't put money into the thrift. For example, the accumulated leave check is not thrift-based.
So this couldn't be rolled into the thrift because as a death benefit?
I don't think so. Okay. I don't know the answer to that, but I sincerely doubt it. If accumulated leave isn't, why would this? I mean, it's a pretty drastic difference between the two, but it's the same concept, a chunk of change, because you did something during your work career.
But it's not the same as life insurance, which is tax-free.
Mm.
Interesting. Yeah, I get the question a lot, and it's always been my understanding that it's taxable. I had heard that it was possible you could roll it into TSP, but I'll defer to your expertise on that.
I would think not, because the TSP is written... Actually, the TSP is written like... the TSP is not a 401k plan. It walks and quacks like one, but it's not the IRS code section. The IRS code section for 401ks, they're mirror images of each other with some major exceptions. Okay, so if you can't put money into a 401k or a TSP, if for any other reason other than salary, it's not salary.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like a bonus. In theory, a bonus. For those that get bonuses, it doesn't go into the TSP because it's not salary.
So TSP really has to come from biweekly payroll contributions on the part of your as an employee, as active employee, and it also accepts rollover money from other outside qualified retirement vehicles, right?
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But only the taxable portion.
Got it.
People think they can just move it over. It's only the taxable portion. There's an IRS form that really separates the two. It's called an 8606. It's not particularly hard to do. You just have to do the first three lines on it. It basically said, what did you put into it over the years that you didn't get a tax deduction for? And you fill out those three lines, and then it says, okay, subtract that number from the totality of all your IRAs. That's the taxable portion. And that can go into the TSP.
And a 401k plan could, you know, assuming that was those were tax-deferred contributions, rolled into.
That can go from a prior employer, or I even talk in class, a future employer. Let's say that an individual retired, and they went to work for somebody, they had a 401k that they didn't like as much as the thrift, and somehow they can maneuver the money, and they can add it in then.
I've heard that the TSP does have some millionaires, and my assumption, too, is that those millionaires probably did what you're just talking about, rolled in money from other
funds.
I
think we'll see more homegrown millionaires over the years, except for maybe last week. But I would say the bulk of them probably the money came from somewhere else because they felt it was a better investment than they could do otherwise. Yeah.
As always, Bob, your knowledge of this amazes me. And it's always great to be able to, you know, I can't tell you how many times I rely on you in the middle of seminars, and I'll reach out to you during noon, and you help me with the tax question.
Well, it's just like you know what you do, and you know it backwards and forwards. And sometimes people say to me, well, you're just trying to get around the tax system. And I go, no, here's the tax system. It allows you to do certain things. You can avail yourself of it. You cannot avail yourself of it. But one thing we won't talk about today is cheating. we're going to stay within the bounds. And one of these articles, I'm not political, but Romney had this huge IRA, perfectly legal, but you know, it got a lot of bad press, and I think some of this legislation that came out because of that. But that's one person, or that's 0.5% of the people in the whole country. Anyway, Bob, I'm sure you didn't see it because you were looking down at your notes, but Andrew told us we have 2 minutes.
Oh, well, very good. I guess at this point in time, one of the things that I'm getting a lot of questions about, I know we don't have much time to go into it, is this whole business of phased retirement. And I would like to call attention to the fact that Tammy Flanagan, who's frequently your co-host on the show, has written an incredibly excellent article, which is in governmentexec.com. I fully advise everybody to read that article. The enabling regulatory provisions are now going out to agencies. We'll be starting to talk about it in seminars. Phased retirement is not an entitlement. It's not for everybody. It's between you and your agency, but it can be a very beneficial thing for some and maybe not for others. So we'll be talking more about that.
Two things. I think Tammy's on next week to talk about it.
Fantastic.
As well as you can go to our website, NITPINC.com, and you can read her archived articles. Andrew's getting nervous. I think we better get off the air.
Okay.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Bob. It was a pleasure interviewing you for a change.
All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.